what's the word intentional mean to you?
And so I went to flight school when I was in the military, and someone once asked me how it feels to fly jets. And I said that it's the moment when, back then, I'm talking about the older generation of jets. It's like you have to put, you know, your mind, your body, everything that you have focus in order to achieve something. And so when you tell me intentional, that's what comes to mind. It's like, how do you pull all your skills together into a specific moment to make things happen?
Welcome to the Intentional Growth Podcast, the show that teaches you how to grow the value of a company with an end in mind. Host Ryan Tansom interviews top business leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and other professionals who share their experience and expertise about buying, growing, and selling companies.
We have a jam-packed episode in for you today. We have Shahar Erez on the show, who has got just an interesting background. He is the co-founder and CEO of Stoke Talent, which was acquired by Fiverr for $110 million after 15 months in the business. And he was backed by leading VC firms, including Battery Ventures and TLLV Partners. He has such a unique perspective because Shahar came from corporate America. And I love the first part of our conversation because you could tell the visceral reaction he had to those memories. But it brings such a unique perspective that he has on how he started the business, why he chose the industry and the business that he was in, scaled up, and then what it was like selling the business to Fiverr. And the business that Shahar created came from this idea of freelancing and this whole gig economy, which he's got some really interesting facts about, and how it's really the gig economy and this freelancing has been obviously very abundant in the smaller size businesses. But when he was in corporate America, it was like, you know, moving the Titanic to get, you know, the corporate America world to embrace freelancers using the platforms online. So that's why he created Stoke Talent, is to bring that the freelancing world to the corporate America, to bigger companies, and creating processes and procedures around that. And lo and behold, he starts, you know, growing in stealth mode as he's building the business, and Fiverr knocks on the door, has a bunch of conversations with Fiverr, and ends up with an over $100 million acquisition in an insanely short time frame that Shahar did not experience or did not expect. And he walks us through the entire journey and why he did everything that he did and how he was thinking about the choices that he was making. If you have not heard me talk about it yet, we have at Arcona have launched what we call the Intentional Growth Financial Assessment. Pat and I created 23 questions that helps you think about your financials today and how the financials should be structured using the three financial statements to understand where you're at today and how to tie that to the future value that you want using all three financial statements and rolling in your strategic plans so you can see your distribution, see your taxes, and see your growth and the cash flow and how that all leads you to a more valuable business, and it's connecting it to the value that you want. And it shows you how you should be organizing your numbers in order to get that kind of visibility and the decision-making. Check it out at arcona.io, or it's in the show notes, and it's 23 questions. You don't need your financials. You just need to go in there, answer the questions, and then you'll get to a results page where Pat and I walk through five different videos to show you what good looks like. And it shows the model that Pat has been using when he was running the private equity firm, and also what the client models look like when they're working with us on the fractional CFO services. Again, everybody, this is a great episode. Shahar was just a blast to chat with, and he's got a lot of insightful gold nuggets for you. So you're in for a treat. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
Sponsored by Arcona's Intentional Growth Digital Course, Ryan Tansom and Pat Hobby show you how to shift your mindset away from solving for annual income to focusing on strategies that create long-term value, giving you the freedom and choices to take control of the future destiny of your business. Accelerate your knowledge with 36 videos and dozens of exercises that combine decades of experience buying, growing, and selling companies. Learn more by going to arcona.io or visiting the show notes.
Shahar, how are you this morning?
I'm great. It's actually evening, by the way.
I was just going to say, before I said that, it was coming out of my mouth. I'm like, it depends on your definition of morning, right?
It's good. It's a good start of the week. We had a good week last week. Business-wise, things are good.
And I'm excited to to dive in, I got your inquiry, and I'm pretty impressed with the agency that you and a couple other folks that have been on the show have been using, because they're actually reading the description of the podcast. And like, hey, Shahar would be a good guest because of these reasons. I'm like, well, look at that. Someone is actually doing their job. So very excited. And what struck me when I was looking at your bio is this whole concept of stealth mode when you had your business that you're growing and then you just sold it to Fiverr within 15 months. So that's the cliff note. And I'm sure there was no challenges whatsoever, you know, easy peasy. No. So I'd love to just, for the listeners, let's give them a 30,000 foot flyby, Shahar, of like, where'd you come from, your background? And then we'll go back and we'll unpack the journey.
So my background, I graduated computer science. What was it, 2002? I got a full scholarship for computer science based on some stuff I did in military. I live in Israel, so everyone does. It's mandatory military service. I did almost 5 years and got a full 3-year scholarship for, I think it was called Proven Leadership and Innovation, whatever buzzword. But I knew I'd never going to be a strong software engineer. Did a bunch of things in startup companies back then. It was the early, the previous bubble burst around 2000. Joined another company, larger company, 2003, got acquired into HP, moved into California to integrate HP and Mercury, joined VMware in 2010, already in product business development roles. You know, it dealt with acquisitions, investments in startup companies along the line. So got exposed a lot into the VC scene, go-to-market, business strategy. Okay. Moved back to Israel in 2013, joined a company called Kinshu, ran product marketing, product marketing, growth, for the company, and about three and a half years ago, started Stoke.
Yeah, and you've already sold it. So, like, how about that, yeah. Right? Not a common
than I originally planned. You know, when people ask me, you know, when you go into, I want to start a company, people, you get so many advice from everyone that knows exactly what you need to do. And some of the advice is like, take something simple and flip it, sell it as soon as possible. It's like, I'm not sure I know how to do this. Usually, you know, in working in Mercury, HP, VMware, usually I used to start long-term businesses, like where is the market going, mm-hmm. and building products and platforms for where the market's heading. So I never thought it's going to be this fast, but it did. So
I want to go back a little bit to your corporate career and what your mindset was. Look at that smile. Like, you have like, I don't know if you got PTSD.
Why do we have to do that?
Right? Some PTSD from the corporate world. But specifically, Shahar, about your mindset and like why you started, because, you know, we talk a lot on this show that there's been this huge rise of search funds and, you know, people call them acquisition entrepreneurs or entrepreneur through acquisition. And just different reasons that people jump out of the corporate world to start their own gig. And I'm curious, you know, what led you to that? You know, especially with some of your exposure to M&A. So like, what was maybe kind of the lead up to it? All right, time to pull the ripcord out of corporate America.
You know, I didn't even know when I started in this business, you know, corporates versus non-corporate. You know, in the 2000s, like, do you work for a company or a startup? No one used in Israel back then corporate. You work for an established company or a likely to go bankrupt company. That was kind of the psychology. And I think throughout my career, Mercury, HP, VMware, I learned a ton. You know, growing up in Israel, small country, our exposure to the Western world as teenager was very limited. Again, Israel is a Western country and everything, but until 91, we didn't have cables. There was no McDonald's here. Mm-hmm. It was like very, very, it's like my world was very limited to everything I knew around the neighborhood. Kind of like growing in a small town in rural America, I guess. And, you know, started working for Mercury and then starting to take business trips and interacting with, you know, corporates and customers and then starting to deal with acquisitions and how do you build a business case for an acquisition? How do you build a strategy for a new product? How do you pitch to an analyst? Like all these things, kind of, you start collecting the knowledge, mm-hmm. that, by the way, it happens without even you noticing it, right? So if people ask you, it's like, I don't feel like I'm moving forward, right? In corporate, it's like, I don't feel, you're doing gazillion things that you didn't know 2 years ago, but you mm-hmm. still feel like you're not moving forward. And so in 2013, when I moved back to Israel, I was still in California. We're talking about moving back. And after spending, you know, the 3-4 years that I did there at VMware, I got a lot of exposure into the VC community in the Bay Area and a lot of startups. This was, you know, right after the 2008 crisis, a lot of new startup companies. And I saw how much innovation these companies are creating and how much fun they're having, how much cool shit they're executing mm-hmm. against. And then you kind of turn around. That was around the phase where Veeamer turned into a corporate itself, right? From, you know, the new kid on the block, breaking normality and just doing cool shit. And I was like, I think I want to do that. And, you know, I started a company. I wanted to be a CEO. The company never succeeded. And I ended up joining Kenchu. And after 3 years, I told myself, I need to do something. I need to find my challenge again. And I didn't know, I wasn't sure if I want to start my own company or just join a company to execute. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feel that innovation again. I think I met, I don't know, 10 different CEOs and VCs. And I was like, I don't want to work for any of these dudes. I don't think any of them will let me execute the way I want, will let me can take the decisions. It'll put me again in the same spot of, you know, I think this needs to be the strategy. This needs to be the DNA. This needs to be the culture. However, you know, there's someone else calling the shot. So it wasn't mm-hmm. about, I wanted to be the big dog in the room or anything of that sort. Just, I wanted something that I feel can be fun, can innovate the way I think about innovation, can execute how I think execution should look like. And so at some point I was like, there's no choice. I'll start something new.
So how did as you finally got to that point, and I'm curious how old your kids were too along this lines, because I was kind of reverse engineering some of the ages you just told me. So I'm assuming you're in the thick of it too. So you're sitting down with your spouse and yourself talking about like, hey, I'm going to do this crazy thing. So what were those conversations like? And then maybe give us some background on the idea that you were pursuing and why you thought it was an opportunity worth pursuing.
So this was 2000 and what was it? 16, 17, I think before I started Stoke, where I think my kids, I'm trying to calculate back.
They were not in the double digits, right? Like, so they were like in the single.
They were 13,
okay.
10, 11 ish. And, seven.
Full, perfect time to just gamble their college.
Absolutely. You know, I joined Kenshu with the when I got sold on Kenshu, it was like, hey, join Kenshu, we're going to IPO within a year. It's like, I'll join, you know, make some money within a year, close the mortgage, be okay, and then I'll start my own company with money. I still didn't see a dime from that adventure. And so
paper wealth, right?
Exactly. You know, I'm trying to go back. What were our conversation? Again, my wife and I have very, we never told, you know, the other side's like, hey, shouldn't do it. It's not the right time. It's like, it's always like, you know, it's just money. We'll be okay. You know, we're not rich. We're not poor. We'll still live our lives. You know, we'll take the next, I don't know, 6 or 9 months, live on some savings. And, you know, I trust you to make it okay. But she didn't, the other side, she didn't know. It's like, this doesn't end once you raise the seed round. You're still making shit money throughout the entire startup run. But it worked out fine eventually.
So what was the idea then, Shahar? What was the idea that was worth taking the risk?
You know, I don't know if it was the idea that was worth the risk. I think it was where I was in my career, where I was with understanding how to build a business, how to build, how to execute, how to raise funds. I think at some point, you know, there's endless examples. Like, do you, successful companies succeed because of a great idea or because of great execution, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have both, that's awesome. But it's like, and you always need luck. I think for me at that point in time, it was like, I want to do something else. Let's explore free ideas. I actually explored and actually set up two different teams to explore two different ideas and test them out. Two different CTOs. It's like, I want to feel comfortable and kind of start taking time to meet VCs and potential customers and get feedback and kind of see what would be interesting. I think the trigger for me with starring Stoke was originally originated with a bootstrap company that my partner and I started in 2013. Because we couldn't raise funds, we ended up not being able to hire employees and start working with freelancers through whatever online marketplace back then. And I saw just tremendous ability to execute using freelancers. Mm-hmm. For someone who grew up in corporate America, to your point, understanding from the moment you have an idea, until you pitch it to your manager, until you get approval to pitch it to his manager, until you get okay, and then hire the people, you get 6 to 9 months go by. Nothing happens in between.
And you cut lots of red tape, hopefully.
Yeah, and it's super frustrating. By the way, when I was at HP, and HP is probably one of the worst, I convinced management, it was 2009, September 2009, HP has a process called PNR, planning review, whatever, something along that line, where you kind of, what's the rather plans for next year? And I came up with a new strategy for a new product, some data science, no one called it data science or anything that sophisticated back then. And I was actually able to convince the management team to give me a $5 million investment to build this new thing. I was like, cool. This is, we're talking, I think the decisions were made in November. I was like, cool. When do we get started? They're like, you're not really getting money. You're getting headcount in the budget off. It's like, okay, where's the headcount? Well, you're going to get 20 people in India, 15 in Bulgaria, 13 in China, 2 in the US. Like, what?
With what rationale?
It's like just where they made people available. It's like there wasn't, you're not going to, we can't hire new people into HP. So we'll give you some people that fell off some trees in whatever, wherever they are in the world. I was like, okay, let's get going. And I was like, no, but they're still occupied in other projects. And so you'll have to wait for the projects to be done and then they'll be yours. This is November. Comes January, I'm still, you know, working out the slides. There's like zero people working on the project. We had a meeting and then I told my the GM or whatever back then, I was like, look, there's nothing left for me to do here. It's like, how many times can I go over the slide deck and tell the story? I'm going skiing up in Tahoe. Call me when the resources become available. No one ever called me. I left in April. No one ever worked on this project until I left.
Oh my gosh. What a waste.
And this is what you experience in corporate. Just the challenges from making a decision, you want to execute something until you get the people, just impossible. And so all of a sudden, we had this experience with freelancers. We wanted something done, and within 48 hours, someone starts working on it. You know, just mind-boggling idea.
And it must have been crazy for you to see the speed to from the thought to the execution of with the people.
Yeah, initially we couldn't believe, because again, we grew up in corporate. For us, working with people means, okay, job description, interview, hiring, it's like this entire thing. And all of a sudden, it's like, why? Give someone $50, let them write something for you, see if it works. If you like it, give them more work. If not, don't ever talk to them again. It's like everything became a lot simpler. And within, I think it was 3 months, we had 13 people working for us on the project. And some of them came in for 48 hours. Some stayed with us for 6 or 9 months from New York, New Rochester, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, wherever. And, you know, not all of them were great. Some of them were decent. Some of them sucked. But whatever it was, you get 70% of something starting to work within 48 hours compared to 100% of something starting to work in 9 months. I would always sign up to the 70%.
And a fraction of the cost too, because you're paying for what you're getting immediately versus
paying for what you're getting. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it's on the job evaluation. So I'm not going through 3 months of interviewing saying, oh, is it going to work? Isn't going to work? Here's a small project. Get going. We'll see if we like each other. We'll see if you can actually pull this together and then we'll decide. And so everything is a lot faster. And so when I moved on to Kentra, I kind of said, well, you know, I want to take this approach. This actually works. And we can make it work within corporate, because, you know, when you're a small startup company, you do whatever you want. It's like you break walls and you swipe credit cards. Then you go into corporate. It's like, well, I want to work with freelancers. Wait. You don't have your own credit card. And it's like, oh, you know, and then I had freelancers that didn't get paid for, you know, 3 months because finance was busy and didn't notice they had invoices in. I had freelancers that got in more than I planned because my Excel wasn't in sync with what finance was actually paying. I had freelancers that their contract expired and they said were still working with us, and had freelancers with access to data and there was GDPR breach. It's like, how do you manage this thing within a company? If you want to make this mainstream within company, there needs to be a solution for that. And that's how we started building Stoke. And the best analogy, you know, there's about 1,000 marketplaces out there today, you know, Upwork, Fiverr, and freelancer.com and 99designs. Like there's all the people per hour. There's really a ton of those. But most of them were built for kind of transactional business. So, you know, you want to swipe your credit card and get, you know, someone to do your twin's birthday video. It's like, you know, pay them.
Oh, my God. We actually did that. And it was Elsa. Someone, no shit, charge. That's exactly what we did. For $50, we got this woman who dressed up as Anna from Frozen and sang to our kids.
By the way, which is amazing, right? It's amazing capability. It's really insane. But if you want to do it within a company, well, it's like who decides whether she dresses as Anna or Elsa? Someone needs to make that decision, right? And so we kind of said, okay, how do we bring this thing into corporate? It's like people in corporate are not going to run after 1,000 marketplaces. They'll need to kind of have a framework within the company where it's like, where do you find the freelancers? How do you onboard them? Which legal documents they need to sign? Do you give them access to the system? Can they track their own budget? How do you keep them compliant and all that? And so, you know, the best analogy, if you think about it, when you take a trip with family to California where it's a bit warmer right now, you know, you swipe your credit card and buy a ticket on whatever, Kayak, Priceline, Expedia, whatever, pick your favorite. But if someone from within corporate wants to book a trip, you can't use any of these. You're probably using Trip Actions, right? Because you need a corporate system where there's governance, control, approval, insurance, all this. And so we're building that system, kind of a CRM or ERP, if you will, for managing freelancers within corporates. You know, as we did the research, all indicators are for over 50% of the workforce becoming freelancers.
Isn't
in the US.
Crazy? Wow.
The numbers are already there. This forecast has been made by the IRS and DOL long before COVID. This isn't started because of COVID. Mm-hmm. COVID's just accelerated it. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, one of every two working Americans are freelancing. I'll repeat it. One in every two Americans is freelancing. And companies, on the other hand, have a challenge in hiring, have a challenge meeting deadlines, have a challenge time to market, have a challenge finding the skills. While all that time, there's about an estimate of whatever, 500 million freelancers worldwide right now. So we want to build a bridge between this growing community of freelancers to corporates that need to move faster. And that's what we built Stoke to Become.
That's so fascinating, man. And just to piggyback off of your how you describe the opportunity, it's just the stuff that I'm seeing too, Shahar, is like, so let's see that you take a $5 million business in revenue, because we have a fractional CFO business, which kind of goes to it's way different than the model you're talking about, how managing freelancers, because they're on our payroll versus, you know, actually being like a freelancer where you'd find them on some kind of job like Indeed or something. But like all these smaller businesses, like one of their biggest challenges to scaling is like, hey, I need a graphic designer. Well, why would you put a $50,000 graphic designer on your payroll when you need like a handful of things a year from them? So like you actually are making it more economical for these smaller companies to scale because they're able to get these resources without putting them on their payroll and having this huge SG&A cost that they don't need.
Absolutely. 100%. I think that it's true for small business, it's true for mid-sized business, it's true for large-scale businesses. I can tell you that at Kenchu, I wanted to kind of restructure marketing. I think I had like 10 people back then. It's like, but these are the people that I had their skills, but I needed right. more skills, not their skills. I needed other skills as well. And so,
and probably not 100% of their skills were the whole payroll, right? Like you could have chunked out 60% of the payroll, but still needed some of those people.
By the way, it's exactly what we're doing. It's like even going podcasting. It's like you want someone to help you set up a podcast. I'll outsource it. I don't have skills in my organization to set up a podcast. And so what I ended up doing was actually laying off half the marketing team back then to make budget available. I had, I think, $700,000, whatever, available, deployed it all into freelancers. And to your point, brought in an SEO expert, an SEM expert, content writers, designers, someone to clean up Salesforce, someone to write up emails. Within 3 months, I tripled all of previous year's leads. Not because I'm an expert, but I have had the right people for the right amount of time that I needed to execute the strategy. And so it helps companies be more efficient. It helps companies get exposure to things that they're not aware of. Again, you didn't really get your share of experience within corporate America, but you know just as much as the corporate knows. And while the world out there is changing, it's very difficult for you within corporate America to understand that the world is changing. As an example, I was just talking to actually Micha, who's Fiverr CEO, And we're talking about Stoke and go to market. And he's like, are you on TikTok? I was like, no, I'm not. No. He's like, dude, this is where people buy today. Get someone to put you on TikTok. And it's like, and I would never think about it. I don't think about it. Because you kind of use, this is what I know. This is, I know this and that. I know LinkedIn, some Facebook, probably works. It's like there's the amount of reach to potential customers is constantly changing. And freelancers are the ones that are opening your mind into seeing things differently.
Ooh, super interesting, man. And it's so interesting because I just wrapped up this project with this gal that is probably the most amazing Google Analytics, Google Data Studio ninja I've ever come across in my entire life. Like I've like, when I met her, I'm like, Allison, I have waited to meet you for apparently 9 years because like we're finally here. But I mean, she's making $100 an hour. So if you actually extrapolate that over a year, couple hundred grand, you know, yeah. And she's working for who she wants, when she wants. She was at a coffee shop. She was in her like guitar studio. And like, here I am. And it cost me like $4,000, $5,000 to set the whole thing up. Like, it's just a bit like amazing of a value exchange, which I just find so fascinating. But to your point, it's information of like, I'm like, so what are other people doing? So I'm hearing from her what's going on in all these other companies that I wouldn't have otherwise if you have someone sitting on your payroll, just attending conferences and blogs.
So you're so correct. We're using Google Data Studio as well. So it's a good example. And when we outsourced that as well, not to Allison, but you know, an equivalent probably.
To your Allison. Allison in quotes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, our Allison. And the thing is, when we started the project, you know, and these guys are starting to work with us, they're saying, well, look, here are your options. These are the tools, these are the capabilities. It's like, instead of us spending time researching or hiring someone, it's like they told us, this is what we've done for companies in your stage. We already tell you within 2 years, you'll need something different. You can make the investment now. You can make it later. But they've seen 20 like us.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I need to learn it myself? And so I think, A, I gained a lot. It works. It fits my budget. It fits my pace. And for Allison, by the way, she has a future-proof career.
100%,
Allison, dude, is working, yeah, you know, with, I don't know, 10 or 20 like you. All will give her good references. Well, maybe 95% will give her good references. So people will stand in line to get her to help them get started, kick things off.
Well, I want to go back to then how you actually set up the business and funded it. And but like, this is just such an interesting concept, man, because also not only you're right, is she future proof her career, but like my wife is, she actually just got a new gig as well. She's a marketing manager. And this applies for, again, you know, we have a fractional CFO business, but if it's fractional bookkeeping or controller work or like you name whatever, Six Sigma. I mean, but like you, if you think about it, you're like, let's say you're a professional and you're like, okay, I want to make $125,000, just making up a number. Okay, I can either go into the corporate grind, like you and I were talking about, there's 19 Fortune 500 companies in Minnesota. So here's your 3% raise, you're a slave to this desk or whatever. Or, and that's it, because you want to make the 125, or you go to the smaller companies where the business owners are trying to make 125. So they're going, hey, marketing manager posted for $50,000. And so like, there's like this huge gap of the lack of the ability that of the people that need the 125 to get them. And I've watched this in this whole great resignation, Shahar, like, I'm like, well, of course, because this $5 million business is posted a marketing manager for $50,000. It's absurd. And so like, there's this mismatch that you're actually kind of like with what you're talking about in the freelance, it's actually filling in the gaps of the value change.
I think the options you've attested to are the right ones, but I think there's something in the middle that you're missing. That if you want to be a freelancer, doesn't mean you're freelancing just for the small businesses. If you're good at what you're doing, Allison is an example, can go be, a data analytics and provide her services to large corporates like Facebook and Google and VMware. And
because they're getting into it, like you're saying?
And they're going to pay her $200 an hour because for them, they can't hire people because it's headcount. Mm-hmm. But paying someone $150 or $200 an hour, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, she can make more money than the 125. She can still have her flexible life and have a future-proof career.
Isn't that fascinating?
And so I think there's a transition there you're seeing. And by the way, we work We have a partner that has a few hundred data scientists that they've collected coming out of MIT, and they kind of offer their services to other companies. These guys are making $250 to $400 an hour. Okay.
I love
and
it.
So man. Freelancing is not just for the SMBs. I do want to add one more thing, though, on people that are considering working for corporates. And I started my career in corporate, so I have nothing against that. But if you get too comfortable within corporate, you're running a risk. Your entire, mm-hmm. not your career, but your future income, your future family life depends on any decision that corporate's going to make. You know, come back every day to the office, work remote, whatever that may be. You're getting a raise, you're not getting a raise, we're cutting people off.
How about the 2,800 people that just got, chopped off of Peloton's payroll?
Exactly. By the way, when we saw that when the pandemic started in April of 2020, the first people that were laid off were the freelancers or contractors, because it's just an allergic reaction, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, they're not ours, let them go. But they were the first to land on their feet because they had the network, they had the brand, mm-hmm. they had the expertise. And so within, 3 to 4 weeks, they all had the next gig. Most of them were not stressed out. But then the full-time employees were starting to be let go. And they were like deer staring at the headlight. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't even have an updated resume. Mm-hmm. It's like, I've spent the last 5 or 6 years here. It's like,
when I have I'm a one-trick pony. I mean, I got people that I know, Shahar, that like, great, you're a whatever, commercial line banker at Wells Fargo making $250. And that's it. And by the way, at any other bank, because you've been there for 15 years, at any other bank, you're worth 100 because you got to start over. And like immediately your lifestyle is upended and you've got no transferability whatsoever. It's you're familiar with Nassim Taleb, Anti-Fragile?
No. Nope.
He's the guy like the black swan. So he's a huge probability statistician. And his whole deal in his book, Anti-Fragile, is like the Uber driver has actually less risk than the corporate worker. To just completely validate your point, minus healthcare in the states where like you need healthcare and that becomes a transferability issue. I want to go back to when you decided to start the business. How did you decide to go the VC route or what? That's kind of kind of gathered. So why that route? How did you like raise it? And what was the whole structure behind the setup?
So. Being in the business, at some point, someone that was one of my mentors growing up in my career told me that not to get confused between a company building software and a company selling software. And so from day one, I knew if I want to start selling something, this is not a B2C model. We're going to build. We need to go to market. We will need to sell this. We need to create a new market category because it didn't exist. And so doing it bootstrap is going to be super difficult. And so I knew I wanted to raise funds in order to build the business and build the go-to-market from very early on. And
is there anything, just to add to that, anything that you did when you were raising? I don't know what level of exposure you had with like the setup of how the investors work. And I don't know how like the corporate setup and the reason behind the question, we don't have to get too technical, Shahar, but you didn't want to be told what to do, right? That's kind of what I was hearing in order to go jump on your own. And I've had a lot of people on this show where they dilute themselves and they don't know all the different things in the operating agreement and the investors agreements where all of a sudden, the founder of Moz was on my show and he's like, he got kicked out of his own company. So like, how did you, like, were you thinking about that when you're raising the funds and talking to investors or how were you thinking about the control and the future direction of the business when you were talking to investors?
It's a great question. And I wasn't an expert again. I was involved with a few acquisitions, HP, Mercury, VMware. So I was exposed to founders and VCs. And I have a bunch of friends, in Greylock and Sequoia and Andreessen Horowitz. And so I think I had a healthy community to consult with. I was also fortunate to get a lawyer that represented us that was really transparent and spent the time to explain to me what I'm agreeing to or not agreeing to and what to insist on. And I think more than anything else, just like you and I having a very comfortable conversation, and I'm sure we'll keep in touch after this podcast regardless. I think it's super important when you're raising funds to make sure that you're taking it from someone that you'll be willing to grab a beer with afterwards. Again, if you have choice, if you don't have a choice, you need money, take it from wherever you can.
Yep.
But if you have choice, take it from someone. It's like, I think it's going to stick by when shit hits the fan.
Yep.
I think I'm going to want to have grab a beer with him later on. I think regardless when I'll make a decision that I want to sell the company or I want to, he's going to be there with me. And I was fortunate, you know, it was a calculated estimate and it proved out to work well. I don't know. You know, I can't tell you that I was very smart about doing it or just got lucky, but it worked well. I'm in touch with everyone on my board. We're still friends. We still grab dinner. Yeah, I wouldn't say we're friends. I don't think we're friends there then, but we still keep in touch and have a ton of that respect. I never felt like it was they're telling me what to do, and I don't have a problem with being told what to do because I don't know everything. It's there's still something stressful, by the way, about walking into a board meeting when you know that it's not as great as you. You always want to show up with great news. It's life. You don't always have great news. Sometimes news are disappointing. But again, I was on the older side when I started the company. Mm-hmm. I was 44, I think, or 43. And
now you're 44 and you've the company's still. I'm just kidding.
I was 46 in November, so I'm not that young anymore. I was fortunate. I had two independent board members. One of them knew me from my Mercury days. And he was in his early 60s. Still, he's in his early 60s. and I think that I had, I was fortunate to have him working with me on a weekly basis. We talked, we brainstormed, we gave you feedback, he challenged me on how to handle the board. I learned a lot throughout the process. And by the way, when we actually sold the company, I was still surprised from a lot of shit that we needed to deal with. Mm-hmm. Just there's
you
shit.
You just don't know what you don't know. So
yeah.
Which is awesome, and like whether it's working hard to get lucky, and or if it's just the fact that you were paying attention to this stuff. So I mean that was obviously you would have caught some red flags if you would have seen them. You know what? You know, going back to one of the earlier comments, Shahar, you were saying that find something quick and easy, then make some money, then go do something a little bit harder. So like, was this in that vein of like what your original thought process was? And so like when you were raising the funds and you were talking to these investors, I hate the word pitch, you know, but like the investment thesis, like, okay, if I do this, I'm looking for this kind of much money, you know, this much money. I'm assuming you didn't say, hey, we'll get this thing sold in 15 months, but it's.
In my wildest dreams, I didn't think that's going to be the case. I started off saying, hey, you know, the future is freelancers. It's not going to happen now. It's a 3 to 5 year journey, at least until the market hits that point. You know, every company will need an operating system to run these freelancers. It's going to take us time to take off. I didn't think this one's going to be a quick one. I don't know if I imagine it's going to be a long one. So it's very difficult. Yeah, a good friend of mine is the CEO and founder at Trip Actions. And he told me back, and he's an investor in the company as well. It's like, you never think when you start a startup company with a friend in a garage or an apartment or wherever it is you're starting it, it's actually going to be a big company. You're saying it, you're dreaming it, but you know, you never think it's quite real because the distance from here to running a company on a day-to-day basis, handling, you know, dozens of people or hundreds of people, payroll and vacation days, it's like all this mess behind, it's like, it's very difficult to run that imagination cycle. But I never thought it was going to be a short run. I never planned to sell the company so soon.
So fascinating, man. And so like, you know, one of the phrases with your booking agent and then on some of your material is that you ran it in stealth mode. So like, explain what that meant for you and why did you guys go about that approach?
So, you know, we didn't go in stealth for a very long time. So our goal was initially to hit the market Q1 of 2020. So we started the company Q2 2019. Our plan was to go to market. You know, we built the product. We noticed that there's no one in the markets that's doing this category yet. It's still pretty blue ocean. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to be too quick to go PR marketing, start talking about something because you don't have the solution. So all you're doing is priming the market for someone else.
With bigger coffers of capital that can just try.
Either bigger coffers or, you know, they just get lucky. One of the things that I've noticed, and by the way, this is an interesting comment to maybe some of the listeners. There's a company called Tatango. I don't know if you know them. They're a customer success platform.
I've heard that. Sounds vaguely familiar.
Israeli founders. One of them is ex-Mercury. We know each other. I think they started 2009, if I remember correctly. And they were the first to build software for customer success. Heads off, they identified the markets going down that path. They started off very early. They built a product, you know, they raised like, you know, Israeli founders back then. It's like $500,000 and then $1 million and then $3 million. It's like very slow. And then I think it was 2012 or 13. Nick Mehta came in and, you know, started Gainsight and raised $40 million and just took over the market. And they became the synonym of customer success. And I think you cannot underestimate by any stretch the value of go-to-market and taking over a market goes way beyond building the right product. And it's not that I'm saying don't build the right product. What I'm saying is if you have the right product, doesn't mean you win. If you win the hearts and minds of the category, you'll match it with a great product. And so it was very important to me that we get the go-to-market right and we own the market. And there is no point in owning the market just yet. And then, you know, Q1 of 2020, we're ready to launch. And then, you know, all of a sudden there is a world pandemic hitting. And I'm like, okay, you know, let's sit on the fence. The board was like, you know, this is Armageddon. You know, everyone's laying people off. We need to cut back. We need to slow down. No one knew, right, that it's going to flip. And so we sat on the fence. We tried to conduct some sales back then. I didn't have any sales team. So I was trying to reach out to prospects. No one would take a call. It was unbelievable. It's not about people saying, oh, the product's not interesting. It was like everyone's super busy and it felt like almost irresponsible or disrespectful. You know, my company's going out of business. You're trying to sell me something.
So it's like, I totally get it, man. I've been there.
So we stopped any go-to-market activity. And so we ended up kicking off or coming out of stealth officially in July of 2020, which was, I'd say, 6 months delayed.
And what did that mean coming out of stealth mode? Like, what were some of the strategies that you did? And then how long did it take before? I mean, of course, and again, it probably sounds so obvious now, but Fiverr, Upwork or something like that just immediately goes, no, thank you. You know what I mean? Like, we'll just take this off your hands because of the competition. But like, from like, you know, that July to like starting to make notice, what did you guys do in July? And then how did you guys get noticed?
So July, we just started, you know, ramping up customers and going back to selling. Took agencies, SDR, hired a PR firm, start producing content, made the decision to start hiring sales and marketing teams and started executing against it. Again, it took a few months for it to actually come into fruition. And then just being super aggressive on KPIs. I was very clear, by the way, from day one. First board meeting in 2019 until today, we follow the same four KPIs. Number of customers, number of contractors on the system, budget managed through the system, and same store growth. These are four KPIs. As you can notice, revenue is not here. Revenue is a trailing indicator, so you never let revenue lead the way. It's like, so we were laser focused on getting customers, getting the number of contractors. We get these two, the rest will follow. It's like, that's how we executed. Everyone was tuned to those four KPIs. And then we started seeing, you know, what happens to a customer that onboards and how do we get successful customers to bring on more customers. And then again, very focused on PR. So I paid significant for a PR firm back then to come out of stealth, onboarded my VP marketing. She's still with us today. Did a phenomenal job just putting in the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So actually, when you look at our graphs from, you know, how much traffic came to the website until January of 2021 till, you know, 4 months later, it's like almost 8x. All of a sudden, it's like you start building in the content, the material, the website structure, you know, pumped up sales from 1 to 5 within 6 months.
Wow.
You know, just primed all cylinders. And we raised another round in between.
Which I've only heard, I've never raised rounds like that, but I've heard plenty of stories. But it's, I mean, you're spending a significant of your time doing that. You know, what's super interesting, Shahar, that I read this, there's two points of this comment is the ability to scale a software product and service is very fascinating to me because like I've got a lot of our CFO clients that are in manufacturing or professional services or whatever it might be. And we don't play in the VC space. So like anybody that's raising rounds, that's not our place. I have some people on the show, but when you like a lot of the money gravitates towards software products because you have a certain amount of man hours that you have to build the product. And then all your cash flow and working capital can be put towards sales instead of buying shit. You don't need inventory of steel or whatever. And so it's so fascinating because you can just literally hit that throttle down and your ability to scale from the money side is just different experience. Any comments on that? I don't know how that impacts other businesses that you've been a part of.
Yeah. So two things. A, you know, the world today is really, it's quite phenomenal because, you know, when we did our insurance or we run and talking to our Ernst & Young, our accountants, and they're like, you know, what assets do you guys have? Like, we have laptops and monitors.
Here's a thumb drive that I can put up the whole website on if you want.
there's no, nothing. Everything's like, we don't have any. It's like, we moved offices. It took us literally 2 hours. Like, we grabbed their laptop and their monitor and we're gone. It's like, there's nothing. Nothing. We're not attached to anything physical. And so you're right. So there's no investment in any inventory. On the flip side, we shouldn't get confused. Scaling up a business, even if it's SaaS, it's different than owning inventory. But setting up the processes from, you know, getting five new customers a quarter to getting 50 customers a quarter, it's a significant painful scale up. Getting the headcount, getting the processes, getting the monitoring in place, getting the payment, getting the billing. It's like there's a lot of different things. There's more and more. Reid Hoffman talks about it a lot, and I really like the way he's talking about it. If you want to have a scalable business, do things that don't scale. And so in the beginning, don't put any effort into scale. Don't try to scale. See if you can make it work. Do it manually. Have more people. At some point, replace people with automation and let people do other things. But don't invest in the beginning in having an automated process. For us in the beginning to onboard a new customer took 48 hours. Someone need to do this, configure that, do this, send out an email like that. It's like everything. It's like, you know, and at some point, the people in the ops is like, why don't we automate it? It's like, yes, it's automatable. But is it where we need to invest? We have five of these a month. Just fucking do it. Do it manually. When we have 50,
take the 48 hours. Please do this because you're getting paid to do the job.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I understand it's stupid. But it's much dumber to spend out 2 engineering months in automating something that happens 5 times a month.
That's just the common sense lens, man. I love it. So as you guys are pushing the go to market and getting exposure and bringing on clients, what led to the triggering event to conversations with Fiverr? I mean, like, how long did it take for some of the big players to start going, wait a second, we can't let them creep into the market like this?
So I think we had a unique conversation with, unique relationship with Fiverr from day one. Because when we started the company, someone connected me with Fiverr's CEO and president back then, because I wanted to pick their brain. We weren't competing with Fiverr. We're going after a different segment of the market, as we discussed. You know, they were back then doing small gigs, you know, Elsa type costume birthday things. We're going after corporates doing more sophisticated long-term engagements. And so, you know, I picked his brains, like, what do we need to do? How do we set it up? How do we handle regulations and compliance, bank accounts, money transfers, like things that, as you were saying, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. All I knew was what to ask. I had a network that helped me ask the right people. And so we kept in touch and, you know, kind of chit-chatted every now and again. And when I did my A round with Battery Ventures, I kind of updated him and he wanted to invest at Stoke. And so one thing led to the other and I met him and Michał's Fiverr CEO. And they actually wanted Fiverr to invest in Stoke. I didn't have enough room for them in the funding round. I mean, they said, it's like, you know, we're Fiverr. We're not going to put $500,000. We're going to put more substantial. It's like, you know, the round's pretty closed. I can't really extend it that much.
Oh, what a great way to reverse sell them, man. Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
I didn't think that was, I thought it might, but I never really thought it's going to take to that extreme. And they didn't end up investing in the company because we can make it work. And I think it was 2 months later, Ofer called me up and said, look, we looked into the market now that we kind of had a conversation. We think it's even more interesting than we thought. We think the market's really happening the way you're seeing it. I think our visions are very much aligned. What do you think about us buying you? Over a phone call. It was very blunt. Again, we're Israelis. We're generally blunt. And I was like,
so you're definitely not from Minnesota. Passive aggressiveness, man. We're never going to tell you what we actually think.
Oh, no. Come visit Israel. Don't worry. You won't make it through the airport. We'll tell you what we think. And so I told him, look, you know, I have $15 million in the bank. I'm no rush to sell this thing. We have at least a 2-year run. But I promised myself, you know, this is a business and I'll treat it as a business decision. If the acquirer makes sense and the business terms make sense, we'll consider. And so we, over the next 2 or 3 weeks, we met, I think, I don't know, 9 or 10 times. Coffees, lunches, you know, each other's houses, whatnot. Kind of sniffed each other bottoms enough to feel comfortable that we should hang out together enough. And once we had it done, it was, you know, it was, in retrospect, it was a done deal. By the way, there was a moment in time, now that you remind me, I completely forgot it. It was a Thursday evening. It was a Thursday that, the story went, we met on a Monday or a Sunday. On Tuesday, I had my board meeting. I didn't tell the board back then that, like, hey, you know, Fiverr reached out with this idea, because it was, probability was still very low. Mm-hmm. I met the board, and the day after we met, and it, you know, moved another step forward. And on Thursday, I felt like, okay, I got to share with this the board. Otherwise, you know, I feel like I'm doing this behind their back. I spoke to the board. The board said, oh, we're willing to do this if we agree to this, if they agree to that. And I was texting with him, and at some point, I was like, look, your maximum probably will not meet our minimum. Unfortunately, you know, I really value our relationship. Let's keep working together. Maybe down the road, we'll reassess. And
did you have any idea what his like range was at that point when you had said that, or was you just kind of assuming based on the conversation with the board?
No, we were in the range. No, we were in the numbers already. Okay. He gave the number and I said no. And he said, okay, we can do this. And I said, okay, let me take it to the board. And I think we kind of understood each other's parameters. And I came back and I said, look, like I spoke to the boards, this is what there are. I said, oh, I can do this. I can't. So I was like, look, all good. You know, we're going to stay keep in touch, probably not going to make it work this time. Your maximum will not hit our minimum. I really value, you know, you reaching out, but it's like, it's not this time. And he replied to me, I think it was like 11 p.m. on Thursday night, but we work here in Israel Sundays through Thursday. So it was Thursday night. And I think it was like 11 p.m. And he replied, it's like, are you a complete idiot? I'm offering you $100 million and you're walking away. I'm not letting you do that. And we met for beers on Friday for lunch. And then, you know, the rest of the story. And it's like, I knew when I got that text, I knew there's going to be a deal.
So like, was that actually, like, how did that synthesize with what the ranges that your board was saying? Like, so was it, did he up it? Or did you go back to the board saying, hey, this is a real $100 million.
I think we ended up changing the structure. Again, I think we upped it a bit, not by much, but I think what we did change was, again, the deal was signed on 95 plus 15. So it was like 95 million plus 15 in earnouts. And so I think what we ended up doing was kind of, instead of going for 100 flat, we reduced the cash to 95 and added 15 in earnouts. And so I was like, we got a bit creative there. Not super creative, not a very complicated deal, obviously.
I was going to say, I've heard a lot more complexity than that.
yeah, it's like, there was an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Barak, who said, whatever is not simple, simply not going to be. And so I believe in simplicity. Keep it simple. There's no reason. We're a simple company. And so we ended up...
What was going through your head, man? I mean, like 15 months, you're like, I'm assuming you're like any kind of entrepreneur visionary is like thinking about their business and their strategies years out. And all of a sudden you kind of got this massive shift in direction. How are you handling that like in your head?
First of all, I think that's the right way to think about it. It's like always think long-term. And even throughout the transactions, like after we signed the LOI, my focus was run the business. If the transaction fails, you still need a functional business. if the business fails, it might kill the transaction. And the, so it's like, you got to always push towards the business, always optimize for the business long term. And again, if something comes up, you know, entertain it. I have to say, within the first, I think, 3-4 weeks, I was very cold about it. My wife told me, it's like, how are you not excited? How are you not going through a nervous breakdown? It's like, this is the biggest thing you've ever done. And you're cold about it. It's like, you're walking away from the deal. You're agreeing to the deal. And it's like, you're not smiling. You're not upset. It's like, you're very, very... And I was like, I felt back then, again, whether it's, I don't know if there was a right or wrong, it's like the only way to handle this is be emotional detached. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't get, I couldn't let any emotions get in the way because it's like, it's going to blind you. So I was completely, I was like, I couldn't, at that point, whether it happens or not, couldn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Like, doesn't matter. Focus on the business. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, doesn't. Once the LOI was signed and we went into, I don't know, these 45 days of due diligence, I was going insane because end up spending 4 or 5 hours a day with lawyers, with business people, with tech people while running the business. And hey, your days are super long. All of a sudden you're working, you know, 18, 19 hours.
Or two jobs, essentially.
And everything, every Zoom meeting, you end up with more homework you need to complete. It's like, these guys are asking for this document. Go fix this and go fetch this and come explain this and let's have another meeting. So it's like you're constantly going through this. And, you know, as the window gets, you know, starting to close on, you're kind of, okay, it's almost over. It's almost over. And you're starting to think about, okay, it's actually happening. And now you don't want to lose it anymore. Because you're already
there's in. That you point of no return in your mind, isn't
it? Yeah, it's like you're already there. It's like you're committed to it. You've set your mind to it. You've invested. By the way, it's not about the financial side. There's the financial side. I can't ignore it. But it's like, it's almost like selling to a customer. You're already there. You see they want to buy the product. It's like you're committed to the fact I want them to fall in love with this shit that I've built. If they say no, that means that I messed up. I didn't think about the money. It's like, if they walk away, that means that I haven't built a successful business. And that will be really frustrating.
That was so probably, I got to pause there, Shahar, because that is probably the best wrapper around the description. I don't think I've ever heard it described like that basic. Because that's the truth. Like I effed up somehow, right? Like I built all of this with the intention of building it for people and customers and all these people for it to work. And then, it's like, it's almost like this big christening of validation, like you are now worthy or not.
Exactly that. It's exactly what I felt. And everything else was side effect. Nice side effect, you know, painful side effect, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, I've built it. It's... we just had the Winter Olympics. I'm not a huge sports fan, but I'm a fan of sporting events. And I watched, probably a neighbor of yours there in Minnesota, Shaun White.
Mm-hmm.
And you watch this guy and the level of, you know, of performance he puts up, right? Just insane throughout his career. And you think about it, you train throughout your time. And then it's like, there's a moment you have, I don't know, what is it? 30 seconds that they're in during that half pipe. It's like, this is your time to perform. And for an entrepreneur, the time to perform was those 45 days post LOI. This is the time to perform. Everything you worked on, everyone's evaluating your company structure, your strategy, your growth, your customer. It's like everything is coming to bear in those 45 days. And so whether you're coming up with the gold or you're walking, you know, empty handed.
Yeah, it's the stakes are high. And in that 45 days, Shahar, did you ever get concerned? Because like I think about your business and I don't know, was it like 2 years maybe at that point from inception to like you don't have like a 3 years of audited financials and like all this like it's more like code. I'm assuming there's a trajectory and a story that the trajectory is telling, but like, were you ever scared that Fiverr, out of all the companies that could take your shit and then say, oh, you know what, we're good, we're not going to go through with this deal, we're going to take the code and, you know, some of the insights we've learned, even though they're not supposed to, we all know that it's a huge risk. Do you ever have any concerns about that?
No. That wasn't a concern. The one concern I had was no one in the company besides me and my co-founder knew that we're actually in this transaction, because I thought that's going to be a risk for running the business. You know, this story about a larger company stealing your idea and mimicking it, building it, is so unlikely. It's not that it's never going to happen, but it's very unlikely. Companies have their focus, have their agenda. They need to focus on it. Building a team now, trying to recreate what we've built over 2 years, recreating the DNA, recreating, they're a B2C company, recreating what we're doing as a B2B company. Could they? Possibly. Would they? Not very likely.
Yeah.
That's and good, so good, you good have insights. To take that risk.
Yep. Is there, I know we're getting close to the end here, you sound like you obviously spent quite a bit of time with the Fiverr CEO, especially because you're in the same neck of the woods. Did you, with the vision of the business, I think, you know, like you said, the money thing, and it was pretty simple and straightforward, but you know, a lot of times people get disappointed or like have, you know, just a different story unfold with the future of the vision, the future strategies. What work did you guys spend getting comfortable that they had the same vision, and what level of rigidity did you have of being like, hey, this is the vision that we have and we want to keep?
So actually, when we started talking about the deal, the first thing I said is, okay, let's assume that this transaction happens. What does the day after look like? Before even getting to the numbers, I said, if we can work out the relationship, the strategy, the structure, great, then we can talk numbers. If we can't, the numbers will not make a difference anyway. And we agreed that Stoke will be kept as a separate company, separate business for at least a 2 year period. And we actually have it in the agreement that we're going to run as a standalone business. Now that it's there again, we are trying to do more things together because I think it makes sense, but we did put in the constructs to help us stay as a standalone business.
Did you have any kind of like budgetary, like you're locking in budgets and resources along with the standalone?
Yes, we agreed that wherever we were from a cash perspective when we joined the company, it's like that's the cash we need to run. We kept our forecast plan on spend and headcount in place. Hardly hasn't moved a bit. I'm still running against my plan from October of last year.
That's awesome.
It's a must, by the way. And I think that we have these discussions around what makes acquisitions succeed or fail. And again, I've seen it. I've seen it fail. I've seen it succeed. I don't think there's a recipe. But I can tell you that if for acquisitions succeed, the company needs to rally behind those acquisitions, put more energy into the acquisitions, find the right structure for the founders to blend into the organization. If you don't handle these three to begin with, then probability is diminishing of the acquisition to succeed. If you take an acquisition, then try to squeeze it, try to manage it through a spreadsheet, which I've seen as well, it's like this is going to be a money-losing acquisition. Well, most companies do that. Most companies invest most of the time about buying something and not thinking about what they're going to do the day after.
Isn't that crazy, man? I've heard that story more times than I can count.
And which is insane still, right? 2 decades ago, I'd say, yeah, you know, it's still just building up. It's like now so many acquisitions, there's so much lessons learned, so much experience, and still again and again, companies mess that up.
And it's getting exacerbated. Like, and this is a different podcast for you and I, maybe over a beer while we're just, just rambling. But like, I mean, because your ability to play financial engineering games of like, you know, the additive and accretive of you add this EBITDA to this EBITDA. Now you got, you know, multiple expansion, multiple arbitrage, and you don't need to do shit to the company afterwards. And it's just a bunch of people looking for their quarterly reports. And it's just destructive for everything. It's like, there was a guy that we're a huge proponent of, and 25-year-old turnaround, top turnaround consultant in the US, public company CFO. His name is Ken Sangenario from the VOP. And he said that, like, I don't know, it's like 85% of acquisitions never are above the cost of capital from the acquirer.
I can definitely see that.
Isn't that crazy? You go through all that crap, and at the end, like, you could have just borrowed money cheaper to just do something yourself.
Yeah, but it's not about that. It's there's acquisitions, its own podcast. I think it's an interesting podcast into test the theory. I can tell you that when HP acquired Mercury, which was a significant acquisition, was $4.5 billion acquisition, not small change. Mm-hmm. And it was a time when Mark Hurd ran HP, and it was, again, financial engineering, to your point. It's like we almost said every year HP bought a significant company through the years that I've been there. And it was almost on purpose to always say, you know, we can't compare this year's numbers to previous year's numbers because, hey, we just made this big acquisition. There was one-time expense. We just did. We have to spend on that. It was always kind of a story around why things are moving. So it's like, we don't want you to see that actually most of our business is declining, but we have this thing that just came in and now correcting our number. It's like, it was insane. And you'll be surprised. I don't know if you'll be surprised. A lot of these acquisitions, someone in the company wants to build a bigger business for themselves to run. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way to justify an acquisition. And when the acquisition is big, that means you're bigger.
Isn't that, it's literally just, it all comes down to people. Like there's been this guy named Ted that was on the show and this Lowell, and they're all in the corporate M&A at some point, Shahar. And they're like, yeah, man, like it's at the end of the day, it might be like hundreds of millions of dollars, but some guy or gal is at the other end going, I'm going to do this to get promoted. At the end of the day, like that's really when they, at the point they lose too many acquisitions and they're going to get so emotional that they just want to buy that deal because it's, you know, their performance report.
Absolutely.
Or even the CEO, CEO's got to report to the board, right? I mean, it's all goes
on. Again, it's all about how do you tell a story, right? I remember when, I think it was Tom Hogan ran HP Software again. This is, I don't know, 16 years ago. And, you know, he bought Mercury, it was 2006, and then he stands up on stage and says, you know, or interview, you know, I've built a $3 billion business. Like, you bought a $3 billion business, you didn't build it.
This is just great, man. It's a... I love it. Well, for everybody's time, I feel like we could go down like this this fun
bigger.
Bigger
I'm not
picture.
I'm coming to Minnesota when it's this cold, though.
Hey, man, we got the internet. So you stay there, I'll stay here. Maybe I'd probably prefer to come to you. So, you know, as we're wrapping up here, Shahar, a couple questions. Two. Love to hear what your definition of the word intentional is. Name of the show, and I love hearing different people's version of it. So, what's the word intentional mean to you?
And so I went to flight school when I was in the military, and someone once asked me how it feels to fly jets, and I said that it's the moment when back then I'm talking about the older generation of jets. It's like you have to put, you know, your mind, your body, everything that you have focused in order to achieve something. And so when you tell me intentional, that's what comes to mind. It's like, how do you pull all your skills together into a specific moment to make things happen?
Yeah, I got some one-liners, man, in this episode. I like it. That was, even though I put you on the spot, you came out ahead on that one. I appreciate that. Best place to find you, more about the business, and especially if people want to know more about freelancing, what you're up to these days, where can everybody find you?
We're on stoketalent.com. Please come visit us. I'm on LinkedIn as well. I don't do Twitter that much. I tried multiple times. I don't know. I couldn't.
And then we all know you're on TikTok now, right? No, we're just kidding.
Don't push me up on TikTok.
Shahar, thanks so much for... Go ahead.
Don't search me up on TikTok. Search me up on LinkedIn.
Shahar, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. This has been an absolute blast.
Hey, Ryan. Had a great time. Looking forward to doing it again and hosting you here in Tel Aviv. I'll come in Minnesota in the summer.
Yeah, there you go. Have a good one, man.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Shahar. I really enjoyed his energy, his authentic presence, and him explaining why he was doing what he was doing. I think he's got a lot of clarity on the choices that he made and why he made them and how he was, how the results unfolded based on the choices that he made. So I just got to say, I really enjoyed the conversation. I mentioned at the beginning of the intro, but if you have not checked out our intentional growth financial assessment, check out the show notes, 23 questions, then you get a score on the different components of the financial foundation, as well as a overall score. And then you have a results page that show a bunch of videos on what good looks like so you can project out the value of your business and get you where you want to go. Thanks everybody for tuning in, and I will see you next week.